ChatGPT was like a game of Pong.
Arnold Schwarzenegger defined what Jack was.
And a really well thought out love story.
Cliff, we're back.
Hey, Scale As Nation returns.
That's right, we are back after a little bit of a gap. New faces and old, but we are here in podcast form, re-entering the podverse after a bit of some time away. I am Kyle Bogart. Here is my brother.
Cliff Bogart.
And here is my lovely fiance as well.
Taylor Stewart.
Thank you, Taylor. Hey guys, how you doing?
So far so good.
Not bad. Good to be back on mic.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, Cliff, why... there are too many film podcasts. I think we can all agree on this. Cliff, why are two bozos like us doing this podcast right now? People want to know. Why are they watching?
Well, the people demanded it. Former fans of our podcast, the Scale Is Needed podcast,
That's right. Is
a podcast, a funny fitness and pop culture podcast
we did with the very talented... picking up heavy stuff. It was mostly about picking up heavy stuff.
Mostly about picking up heavy stuff, but we tried to make it as much about the silly things we wanted to talk about as we could, with the very talented Arm & Hammer, and who will likely be appearing in guest episodes in the future. But... on that podcast, we talked a great deal about movies and pop culture, and there are still fans of the podcast who want to check it out and hear us talking about movies, which we do all the time outside of the Podiverse.
Yes, you think they would have given up on this after 5 years, but when we post pictures or anything to the old things about the old podcast, we still get lots of comments and lots of people saying that they would like to hear us talk about movies. So here it is. If you enjoy this, you got what you asked for. But joining us as well this time is Taylor Stewart. Taylor, how are you? Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I am well. I am excited. I am a lifelong film fan and excited to get into the whole filmiverse.
Yes, actually, Taylor is our partner in crime. We all live here. In the same place, and we go see movies as a trio all the time, and we see a bunch of movies in the area, so it just made sense to make a podcast out of seeing movies and stuff, and so it was seeing movies in theaters specifically. So we should take a minute to address that. So the premise of this podcast is we are not going to take it easy on ourselves. We're not going to cheat like other movie podcasts that watch movies on DVD or on the internet or on streaming. No, we are going to see all of the movies. We'll pick the movies we see, but it will be dependent upon, I guess, what's playing around. Some new movies, but mostly old, I think.
Oh, yeah. I think we'll definitely watch all the new movies that make a big pop cultural splash and comment on them as they go. But we are lucky enough to live in the city of Austin, Texas, where there are a great many theaters which do have great repertory programs and play movies of all eras.
Yes.
Such as this month, which is the month of September, I believe, the Alamo is doing a 1984 retrospective where they're doing the movies of 1984.
Yes, and one of them we'll get to in just a moment. We'll hopefully see some stuff. Also, we live very close to the AFS Theater, so we're planning on seeing some stuff there. And I think the more so than just making it hard on ourselves, I really do think that seeing movies in a movie theater is a unique experience. It's different. You can see a movie at home, and you can just react to it yourself. But when you see a movie in a big theater, in a crowded theater, hey, which is the title of the podcast, in a crowded theater, I don't know, it is like seeing a movie with 1,000 pairs of eyes at once. You feel things you wouldn't otherwise feel. You see things you wouldn't otherwise see. And movies are just better when you can feel people laughing and doing all of that. So, I don't know, I've always felt that way about seeing movies in theaters and thought if one was to do a movie podcast, one would do that and just see movies in theaters and talk about that experience. And now we're doing that podcast right now.
That's right.
There you go.
Time is a circle.
That's right. We're back to it. There you go. Time is a circle. Cliff, are you excited about the crowded theater?
Oh, I'm super duper excited about it.
What should the mascot be? Should it be a crow or perhaps a crawdad for crowded? The crowded crawdad.
There you go.
Or perhaps the crowded crow. I don't know. We'll figure it out eventually.
I like
Tell us in the comments.
That's right. Tell us in the comments. So anyway, to kick things off, boy, are we kicking things off in the right way. We are kicking things off in a movie that it is pretty singularly influential, pretty singularly heralded. All of the people involved went on to have hyperbolically, superlatively successful careers that affected not only their lives, but were somewhat transformative of the film industry and the world. And I don't think that's an understatement when you consider that this was the film that launched the careers in to the next level of Arnold Schwarzenegger, James Cameron of Avatar, and of course the great Dick Miller, who Dick Miller's in there as well. No, the movie we are watching to begin this, and of course, again, we Scale is Needed was all about being jacked, and there's literally almost no movie where there's more jackedness singularly in a human being than the movie we are beginning with. We are beginning with 1984's The Terminator, released on October 26, 1984, Cliff's first birthday.
That's right.
That's right. Cliff was born on October 26, 1983. So like Cliff, Terminator is a Scorpio. So there you go. Taylor, tell me, is Terminator a Scorpio like Cliff?
Oh, you know, I would say it's very emotionally driven. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of hidden meanings under the surface. You have like the front story and then the understory.
And yet the Terminator himself has no emotions. So he's definitely not a water sign. Probably.
Yeah, he has no sign. In fact, he has a forward sign.
Cliff, as a Scorpio, do you relate in any particular Scorpiotic ways with this?
Well, I guess the most straightforward connection I can see is that I think the tarot card that represents Scorpio is the card of death.
Yes.
And it has the figure of death with the sickle on it and all that stuff. So certainly the Terminator represents a unstoppable force of death,
yes,
almost supernatural in its capacity,
yes,
and blah, blah, blah.
And the death card in the tarot also features a Skull Knight, which is basically what the Terminator is. So we really have found a fantastic connection to weird shit. But more on that later, and things will get even weirder, folks. I promise you. So this film was written and directed by James Cameron, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, Linda Hamilton, Michael Biehn, Lance Henriksen, and most important of all, Dick Miller as the gun shop owner, but we'll get to him in a minute. A quick plot summary. The Terminator is about a cyborg assassin from the future who attempts to find and kill Sarah Connor, as if you didn't already know. Who attempts to kill Sarah Connor, a waitress who is destined to give birth to a man who will save humankind. They say a man as if we don't know his name. She's destined to give birth to John Connor, the savior of humanity, who has the same initials as both James Cameron and Jesus Christ. Think about it. He's the savior, Immaculate Conception. Think about it. All right, we'll get to all that and stuff. Again, I told you we were going to get weird. We don't have to cover any CrossFit or weightlifting on this podcast. This gives us the time to get as weird as Cliff and I can possibly get. And boy, we're going to go there.
All I'm saying is that Shroud of Turin does look a whole lot like James Cameron if you put his face over it.
That's
try
right.
Try it out online, folks.
Or does it look like the Terminator? Think about it. What is this movie about? We're going to solve all of that before the end of this podcast, I promise. I'm just real quick, I think just because we want to point out that we did see it in theaters, that we're not just these fucking bubblegummers who are watching movies on DVDs. No, we saw it at the Alamo Drafthouse on Slaughter Lane on Tuesday, September 6th at 7:40 p.m. An interesting note on that theater. Could have seen it anywhere, but we saw it in a theater where in the lobby, if you go to the Slaughter Lane, they have the loader from Aliens.
Oh, yeah, full-size loader right there for everyone to check out. You can't get in the seat, I don't
Sorry,
think,
the, and to just to, just to clarify, that is the mech, the if you will, the mech suit, the
yes,
big yellow thing that Sigourney Weaver wears at the end of Aliens. You know, get away from her, you bitch! They have a replica of that in the lobby, which has been there for years, and yet we were there seeing a Terminator. Mm-hmm. Another good omen for this podcast.
So definitely, if you're ever in Austin, Texas, check out the Alamo Slaughter to check out the loader. My first impression upon seeing its life-size mock-up is shorter than I expected.
Yes, yes.
That's I think what will strike many of you. It's like, okay, it's not quite as an imposing figure against the Queen Alien as we initially thought it would be. But that is the next James Cameron movie, exactly. The previous James Cameron movie, 2 years earlier.
Yeah, and this is a film that, I mean, that segues, the films are very, very intimately connected, because we'll get into it in just a moment, but actually, this film, because Conan the Destroyer was made, it ended up taking Arnold Schwarzenegger away briefly from the ability to shoot the movie. They delayed the movie, and during that delay, to make money, James Cameron took on the job, just the writing job, of writing the sequel to Alien, and wrote Aliens before production on Terminator, then made Terminator, which became a huge unexpected hit for such a small movie, and then he was suddenly in contention to direct Aliens. So this is definitely the film that led in every way, and is very intimately related with Aliens. But we'll get to all that in a minute. Let's talk about this movie, though. Let's talk about Terminator. Terminator leaves a pretty large footprint. I mean, literally as a springboard from this, Arnold Schwarzenegger would go on to become the Governator. He would go on to become the biggest action star and kind of in the same way Marvel redefined movies in the 2000s, Arnold Schwarzenegger redefined the economics and the aesthetics of Hollywood in a rather significant way in the 80s. And this Conan the Barbarian had come before this, but really this was his springboard into superstardom and all of that. And James Cameron, of course, would go on to direct Terminator 2, Aliens, ultimately Titanic and Avatar. He currently has the number 1 and 2 spot of the most successful films of all time. And as you all know, Dick Miller would go on to star in many, many, many great movies from there, like Explorers. And did Explorers come out after? Would have come out after, right?
Around the same time. I'm going to say a couple years later. I'm going to say 86 for Explorers, cool. Just pulling that out of my ass.
But we'll get more into Dick Miller in a minute. Anyway, guys. Why is this movie so significant? Again, just to tee it up, it is a miraculous movie that succeeds on the strength of its content, on its ideas. It was a film that was made for what would have been a very, very, very low budget. It was a film made by two people who did not have much of a career, who were coming out of Roger Corman's, or who had no film careers really, but who were coming out of Roger Corman's productions at New World Pictures. James Cameron was doing special effects and production design on movies like Battle Beyond the Stars and Galaxy of Terror, which we can also talk about here in a minute because we watched Galaxy of Terror last night. Gail Ann Hurd was Roger Corman's assistant. They got into a relationship. They got married. He wrote this script.
Gail Ann Hurd was... James Cameron and Gail Ann Hurd got married. Yeah.
Yes, not Roger Corman and Gail Ann Hurd, but Gail Ann Hurd. And James Cameron also did not marry Roger Corman, just to be clear. They get married. They weren't married at the time. I'm not sure. I can't exactly recall, but they end up making a movie that, you know, because James Cameron is stretching every dollar and is doing all the special, or doing a lot of the special effects himself, and has been doing a lot of that same kind of work for Corman, and even Corman said at the time they were doing, you know, Star Wars level work for, you know, bargain basement prices, and Cameron sort of approached the movie trying to put as much as he can on the screen. We have this idea of the movie as some sort of big action blockbuster surefire hit in the vein of, a lot of the Schwarzenegger projects that followed. And yet, it's a film that, on the strength just of its story, which we'll get into, and its supreme execution, just launched the career of arguably the most successful director and most successful star of the next 20 years and just to let everyone know that when they first screened for the marketing people of Orion Pictures when they were making it, they said, we can't screen this for critics because this isn't even a science fiction movie. It doesn't even have magical technologies in it or anything. It's just a dirty, weird action movie and it won't last 2 weeks. And they were very wrong. So Cliff, tell me about what is the story of this movie? Where did it come from? Let's talk about the script of Terminator.
Well, I think its genesis came from the idea that James Cameron wanted to do a sci-fi movie on a low budget. Mm-hmm. And so he figured that time travel mm-hmm. would be a concept that would be highly useful for that, because you can have it's set in modern day, but futuristic things come from the future. And so based on that, he came up with the idea of a robot coming from the future to kill, to affect the future in some way. Mm-hmm. And from that, the treatment of Terminator developed. Lore has it that in just 2 weeks, he wrote a 45-page treatment, mm-hmm. and we've read it. It's a really awesome treatment.
It is a fantastic treatment.
All the scenes of the movie, as you know, it's many of the lines, but yeah, basically every scene that's in the finished movie, including and plus some that were later cut, is present in that treatment that kind of all exploded out of his brain right there.
Yeah, and worth noting also that the inspiration, the moment of inception for what would then become the treatment, the genesis of the movie was James Cameron was, I think, in Rome on his shooting Piranha 2, the sequel to the Joe Dante movie, which was going to be his first film he directed. I think he was fired from that movie, but he said he was very, very sick in his hotel room and got a fever, and then while he was having a fever, began to have visions of this metal skeleton, not unlike the Death Card. Mm-hmm. We'll come back to that in a minute. This metal skeleton emerging from fire and various other of the images. So I like what I love about this is that it appears that there's some sort of weird, crazy magic that he sort of channeled in, and the original images that sort of would become the iconic end of the movie were sort of delivered to him by some spirit or demon, just like how when Black Sabbath was formed. That's a different story for a different time, but there you go. Cliff, how do you feel about that?
All righty. If it was inspired by demons, that seems spot on. Pretty cool.
That's what I'm saying. Well, we'll get... Well, don't worry. We'll get a lot more into demons later, everybody. Okay, there's a lot more demon talk in this thing. But, no, the original 45-page treatment is fantastic because there's a lot of films, similar films, science fiction action films, even a film like Alien, where there was a script generated at one point by Dan O'Bannon that then is rewritten by Walter Hill, and then there's contributions from H.R. Giger, and then ultimately Ridley Scott makes it. There's all these different things that come together to eventually create the film and the tone that we ultimately see with Alien. And yet with Terminator, it is so very, very, very singular. It is all right there in the treatment. Like, you can read that treatment, and I strongly recommend you can find it online, get a PDF of it. But that original Terminator treatment starts out with the amazing premise of, you know, the guys showing up, time travel, beginning to hunt down Sarah Connor based on the order from the phone book, all that shit, and it just reads like you are experiencing the movie. I mean, all the scenes, all the moments, even all the action at the end where he's, you know, all the bits where he's adjusting the cybernetic elements underneath his skin, like the whole complete vision for the movie is in that 45-page treatment and some other things that weren't there. Cliff, what were some of the other things that were... There's other stuff in there.
I can't remember quite off the top of my head. I think, yeah, there was Reese was sent down with another guy who got teleported into a railing. There was some additional scenes with Ginger and stuff, I recall.
Oh, yeah, because, yeah, there's a guy who gets teleported down with Reese, so it's two guys who go back, and except he gets teleported into the middle of a fire escape ladder, which is a very fun thing, that's just a cool science. That's just a cool idea. And it also, I think, sets an interesting tone for, like, how perilous the journey is that Kyle Reese is on when he first arrives. Comes back in time, Terminator and Kyle Reese, etc. And there was a couple other things. I think there was one thing where, like, Sarah Connor had, like, some... They knew something about a surgery or something that she had. So the Terminator was, after he killed the previous Sarah Connors, he was, and this was like the calling card of it being like a psycho murderer or something, is that he was like cutting open their, after they were dead, cutting open their legs and examining their shin bone for like a brace or something on the bone. It was some other element that was in there. So, but just other cool ideas throughout. But regardless.
Oh, wait, now I'm remembering one. One thing is it expanded a little bit upon the living tissue over a metal endoskeleton premise. It actually expanded upon it, saying there was a little chicken heart, chicken-sized heart and lungs and all that stuff beating away, keeping the flesh alive. And at one point you see the Terminator eat, I think, a Snickers bar. Describes him eating the Snickers bar as just shoving the whole thing in his mouth, wrapper and all, and chewing it down in order to keep the little bits of flesh alive. And I think it does specify at what point the flesh dies. I think it is the after the cop what is it, after the police station, it specifies that the living human tissue dies and begins to rot. Hence the guy coming up to his door in his hotel room a little bit later. Hey, you got a dead cat in there or what?
Mm-hmm.
And he responds humorously after selecting many funny lines. Mm-hmm. Fuck you, asshole. Mm-hmm. By the way, it was one of the great pops in the theater in the audience was when you saw him select all the possibilities and land on fuck you, asshole. Everyone laughed first and then, of course, laughed at the line. But anyway, yeah, in the screenplay, the flesh was dead and rotting at that point, which is why he stank.
Yes.
But, yeah.
Fantastic. No, I love that. That is awesome. The and also we have, so just to kind of round out what made the treatment so compelling is obviously the amazing conceit of the movie. This idea that Sarah Connor, who is not a scientist, not an engineer, not some person who works for a big important technology company.
She's a waitress that can't even balance her own checkbook.
Exactly. She is a waitress that can't even balance her own checkbook. Something that Taylor cannot relate to at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she finds out when Kyle Reese comes back that she is, of course, going to give birth to future robot killing Jesus, John Connor, if she does not come with Kyle Reese.
Come with me if you want to.
Exactly.
Also, just a quick tidbit.
And they do, in fact, come together later on.
As somebody who was born in the mid-90s, and I can say, who may not have seen Terminator in the peak of its time, so many lines. Like, I feel like we're in an era right now of movies that do not have the zinger one-liners. And I feel like even just the fuck you, asshole, and the come with me if you want to live, and I'll be back, and all of these things are just so...
Oh, and my speculation, by the way, on the fuck you, asshole line was that the Terminator, this is not in the screenplay, but my speculation, is that the Terminator got called or yelled at fuck you, asshole, by Bill Paxton in the first scene.
Ah.
I think that's a new phrase that he learned there and then selected that.
I agree.
For that.
Holy
I don't.
I never thought, like, we've watched this movie for a million years. I never thought of it. And I can hear as clear as day Bill Paxton in the beginning saying, fuck you, asshole. And yeah, of course, the fuck you, asshole. For those of you
and
who don't know.
He says it back.
Yes, yeah, so for those of you who don't know, the great. Oh, that's right. He says it right back there. Why have I never thought of this before?
Yeah. So I always assumed that the Terminator learned the phrase
that's
from
crazy.
The punk at the beginning, and that's why he had that phrase right at the front of his metal brain.
This is a great example of what happens when you see a movie from the age of 4 on. You just take everything in it completely for granted. And I'm just, which if you don't know, Bill Paxton also plays one of the punks at the beginning. Bill Paxton, who would then go on to be Hudson, game over, man, in Aliens and a star in Titanic and a bunch of other James Cameron projects, etc., etc., etc. And he's one of the greatest actors of all time. Rest in peace, Bill Paxton. But yes, no, for whatever reason, that daisy chain had never connected until now. But fuck you, asshole, and that's where he gets all of his curse words from. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. God, I love it. And I think, honestly, that's why you say that, you know, the film has great lines, and you can say it has great special effects, and you can say it has a great story and has great performances and all this other stuff. And it is obviously, I think that all of that works because you give yourself over so completely to the movie on a story level, because it is so exquisitely directed, which brings us to the man himself, not screenwriter James Cameron, but director James Cameron, who, it's really interesting to look at how successful this film is at feeling much bigger than the budget that they had, of feeling how successful the film is overall, but how visceral and how, let me take one big step back and say, James Cameron was working for Roger Corman at the time, doing all of these kinds of special effects. So he's the guy who, in Battle Beyond the Stars, is moving the camera past a bunch of spaceships to make them look like they're going through space.
That is a Roger Corman Star Wars ripoff.
Yes.
That was done shortly after Star Wars. So basically, James Cameron is doing all the Star Wars special effects on a low budget.
Mm-hmm.
And very soon followed by an Alien ripoff.
Exactly.
What was it called? We saw
Galaxy of Terror.
And so James Cameron was already doing Alien-like special effects on a low budget, ripping off Alien just prior to doing Terminator and, of course, later Aliens.
Yeah. And for those of you who don't know, Roger Corman, who is maybe perhaps the greatest hero in the history of cinema, who just sort of existed entirely outside of the Hollywood system and created the careers of people like James Cameron, helped foster the careers of people like James Cameron and Martin Scorsese and Ron Howard and Francis Ford Coppola and all of these people who kind of came through that whole system. He was not making films for a little bit less money than the studio. studios, or like half as much money as the studios. He was making films in a couple of weeks for a tenth of the budget. Sorry, and sometimes an even smaller fraction of the budget of studio films. So when ILM was doing spaceships and miniatures and all this stuff for Star Wars, he finds young, hungry, talented people who want to do that for a fraction of the price. And he finds, among those people, a young James Cameron, who I think was doing special effects and stuff on Battle Beyond the Stars. And then what's really interesting, if we want to talk briefly about Aliens, is the fact that he essentially, with Galaxy of Terror, he was, I think, a production designer and a first assistant director on that movie. And if you look at it, it feels like the rough draft of, A, some things that are in Terminator, but especially the rough draft of all these things that are going to be in Aliens later. Because he essentially gets to create a weird alien, because it's a fucking Alien ripoff. So, I mean, it's just about a spaceship landing on a weird alien planet and climbing, astronauts climbing into a big fucking pyramid and going down weird organic looking halls and all this stuff that in a slightly gussied up way, in a slightly more robust way, we would see in Aliens just a few years later. And you would also see him using all of these insane matte paintings and reverse compositing and reverse projection technologies and really trying those out that you would see in Terminator right now. And that is the thing, if you want to get into it, Cliff, that gives this very, very small movie an enormous sense of scale. Because I, for one, when I was a kid, I never thought of the hunter killers as tiny little models. Mm-hmm. I just assumed they just read as giant robots. Well, they had to be giant.
Oh, yeah. And the thing that actually freaked me out the most was finding out that the the gasoline truck explosion was a miniature. Because that was always, as a kid, my favorite explosion in all the movies was that gasoline truck exploding. I used to draw pictures of it. In preschool, just on pieces of paper.
What are you drawing, Cliff? A cleansing fire that will wipe away all of our sins.
Yes,
and then we'll be one with God.
Yes, every teacher at every grade was concerned. Yes, that entire thing, that entire, not just the truck, but seeing on some special features just earlier today, special features on, I think, the Terminator Blu-ray or something like that the entire street was a miniature set, obviously, in order to fit that. So they basically recreated that chunk of street that Sarah Connor was running from the truck, and it, you know, you see the truck, full-size truck, hit that car, she's running from it. They recreated that entire section of street just to make a car, just to make a truck that was, you know, a couple feet high.
Yeah, it's like 8 feet long.
Explode in that super cool way, loaded with all those explosives that exploded from the back to the front.
Yeah, so Taylor, did you realize that truck was only like 8 feet long that explodes at the end of the movie? Isn't that crazy?
Not even a little bit. That's
yeah, no,
crazy.
Isn't it crazy? Especially, it's just, again, there's plenty of bad miniatures, as there's bad stop motion in the world, and there's bad other stuff, any kind of rear projection. But when it is done exquisitely well, which doesn't just require the special effects to be good, but it requires a total integration with the filmmaking, which is, I guess, in some ways easier to do now. I mean, a lot easier to do with digital technology, but it looks realer than real in this weird way that, like, when the hunter killers roll over the little skulls at the beginning of the movie, those miniature skulls, when the truck explodes, they look not only exquisitely real because of how well the miniatures are being photographed and how well the forced perspective works and all that, but because, and this is something you even see a little bit of in Galaxy of Terror, which we just happened kind of coincidentally to revisit last night, which is the Roger Corman produced Alien ripoff, is you see that he shoots around, like when we cut to the dystopian future where we see Kyle Reese now in the year 2029, and we can talk about that in a minute, in this dystopian post-apocalyptic future. We were actually talking about this a bit this morning, how like all those miniatures had to be incredibly hazy to create a sense of depth of field. That's why they did that with, like, when Douglas Trumbull was working on Blade Runner. They had to be, by hazy, I mean the literal air was pumped full of a haze that's called atmosphere, just to give it, to make it feel like as the air and the miniature falls off into the distance, it would sort of become more opaque as it would if it were larger. And so you see that the world created, actually in Aliens, both on LV-426, in Galaxy of Terror when they land on the planet, but here in Aliens, when we see Reese going through that world...
In Terminator,
we see a very hazy blue world that perfectly matches these miniatures, so that when... I mean, I don't think a lot of people realize these battle scenes where Kyle Reese is taking down... hunter killers, when it kind of cuts flashbacks to the future, if you will. Flashbacks to the future. Back in time. We should do a Back to the Future episode when it plays sometime. That would be fun.
By the way, quick weird relation between these two. Terminator was released on October 26, 1984. And then Back to the Future, the date that he travels back to the future October 26, 1984. 85.
Yes, and Cliff was born on October 26, 1983.
What does it mean?
And I was born on September 26, 1985.
But anyway, those two movies, time travel movies, having that October 26 connection, in fact, did Robert Zemeckis pick the October 26 date in homage to Terminator, which came out on October 26, maybe. Yes. Maybe not, probably not, but, you know, there you go.
Yes. No, I mean, that's, all right, yes, exactly, and we know that that's real. I'm backing it up immediately, and I buy it. But just before I lose this thread, I think a lot of people, if watch Terminator again, and you will see what a deceptively small movie it is, and it requires such exquisite execution to hide that fact. If you look, the little Kyle Reese soldiers who are running along at the bottom of a frame underneath giant hunter killers, it's just a rear projection screen of a miniature that was shot before that that's all being filmed together. But because... unlike, there's brilliant moments in like Galaxy of Terror, and there's great moments in Beyond Battle Beyond the Stars, but the filmmaking in the scenes with the fucking actors where they're walking around and talking to each other is not at all aesthetically not as well aesthetically integrated with the special effects shots, and so it doesn't feel like, it feels like you're cutting away to some sort of miniature or some sort of effect, whereas this film feels so seamless that the performances that are being driven by, you know, Michael Biehn and crawling around through this blue little wasteland and trying to throw a bomb underneath the hunter killer, it adds scale and drama to these machines that makes, they're fucking miniatures, but they feel huge. And it's, and anyway, it's just, it's the kind of thing where it was, again, a relatively small movie, but where he took all of these skills that he had acquired working on a low budget for Roger Corman for all of those years and finally got to do it his own way in his own movie. And the result was fucking phenomenal.
Well, yeah, I think history speaks for itself.
It does. It, indeed, it does. And there's other stuff, too, obviously. I mean, there's just so many smart approaches to little visual effects moments, like when the Terminator first... we're just kind of skipping ahead here, but when the Terminator first emerges in fire at the end, you know, it's stop-motion critter, and he pushes that piece of metal out of the way, but they have a foreground shot of Michael Biehn of, like, a mechanical arm of the Terminator pushing something out of the way, and it just ties in the shots of the filmmaking in a very clever way with what's going on with the stop-motion stuff. So it all feels connected as in this way, and it, I don't know, it's just a...
I'll also throw out the stop-motion of the big metal skeleton near the end of the movie, or the climax of the movie, is also kind of adds to the unsettling nature of, like, now that he's, like, truly falling apart and not quite able to walk as smoothly as he was when he had his flesh suit on.
It helps that he's a robot, because the jerkiness all makes it fucking work and make it feel like that's just how he moves, because he's a robot. So, anyway, it's... so you have this really incredible fucking treatment that we talked about. You have this incredible execution of this guy who had this enormous talent and all of this kind of desire to see these effects and things done right, to kind of make his own movie. He had had all of that industry. He has the opportunity to make the movie. They put the thing together, and he ends up casting... well, who does he end up casting, Cliff? What is the story of how the Terminator was cast, Cliff?
As James Cameron has told in many a Q&A on many a Blu-ray special features set, is that originally Arnold Schwarzenegger was suggested, I think, by the producers for the role of Kyle Reese,
the hero,
which doesn't really bring as making sense given that role, but and James Cameron thought so as well. But he had a meeting with Arnold Schwarzenegger, premised on the idea that Arnold Schwarzenegger would be playing Reese. But they each, what James Cameron got from the meeting is that, one, Arnold Schwarzenegger really liked the story and was really passionate about it. And two, that Arnold really dug the idea, dug the character of the Terminator. And I guess, three, that he thought that Arnold would be a really great Terminator coming from that meeting. And Arnold thought the same thing.
And originally he conceptualized the Terminator as more of an everyman figure. And where Lance Henriksen, who was in the film and who, of course, would go on to play an android in his very next film, Aliens. So Bishop, the android in Aliens, was originally going to play the Terminator. And when you think about that, it just makes it a radically different film in a lot of ways. But it's funny. You could almost say that it was as if Lance Henriksen were playing the character, but it was the character on steroids. That's it. Feels very much like like the thing. Just in that, one can completely see how a utterly anonymous looking Terminator, kind of like Robert Patrick in Terminator 2, is terrifying. It works. There's nothing that undermines the idea of the film by having him be not super fucking jacked. And yet, just, it's not addressed, it's never mentioned textually, but just purely through the casting choice of having this larger-than-life man play, I mean, someone who truly had this crazy singular physique, in a weird way, you would think would be distracting, and yet it makes the character something other than just a man who is a secret robot. It makes him something that sort of transcends that, and he looks like some sort of behemoth designed by robots to look like what a human would look like if you made the most badass human, etc., etc., etc.
Just had so much robotiness under there that it took someone the size of Arnold to contain it all.
Yes, indeed, indeed, indeed. And
aren't we glad they couldn't send back clothes from the future?
Yes, because you got to see lots of butts.
Oh, yeah, extended butt.
And lots brief, of butt. Brief flash, you blink and you miss it, of the Arnold Wang doodle.
Oh,
Arnold
his dong is in it?
Oh, you betcha.
I missed his...
God!
Yeah, when he's walking, when he's walking towards the punks, and the punks are looking at him right before they say, "What's something's wrong with this picture," you briefly see Arnold's dong flash into the light a couple times there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which you could see very clearly on the big screen, much
Don't
more
worry.
So than on the little screen.
We'll pause it later. We'll go frame by frame, and then we'll put that frame up here. For those of you watching on YouTube,
I'm welcome.
There you go. What is it? Making again, Arnold, I guess, had done Conan the Barbarian up to this point, so he had done Pumping Iron. We actually have a Pumping Iron DVD on the table right now, which is fun. Another thing, along with Arnold's dong, you can enjoy on the visual part of this podcast on YouTube. But he was Conan the Barbarian up to this point. But again, there's really nothing to say about Arnold playing the role other than, you know, being Austrian, being big, being all of that. It was just sort of the perfect instinct of casting, a perfect fusing of sort of performer and role that sort of became something that transcended both him and the original part as written and became something incredibly, incredibly iconic, to the extent that they had to Schwarzenegger didn't really play bad guys after this anyway, but made him the hero of the next film. And I don't know, it was something, it launched him to becoming something that was, and even that transcended even just being an action star and all that. Why is it? What was the key, Cliff? Is it just the jackedness that is the key?
Clearly, Arnold has something else special going on with him besides just the jackedness. There's lots of jacked fellows, even though he was a Mr. Olympia. There's plenty of other Mr. Olympias and other jacked fellows since then. So clearly, there's some singular kind of charm Arnold has.
Would Lou Ferrigno, the Terminator, have worked as well, Cliff?
Well, honestly, in a role that required that little speaking, maybe Lou Ferrigno could have pulled that off.
His face is too friendly, I feel. Even though he played the Hulk, he has a very friendly Italian face, as opposed to the cold, cold German face of Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I think that that is the thing that that is what makes it work for sure. I don't know. Let's just go with that. You know, interesting other stuff. So Cliff, speaking of which, he's coming off of what was I actually heard someone speculating at one point, just saying, and I thought this was funny. You know, I know Arnold Schwarzenegger did, in reference to his body in Terminator, I know that he was very big because he apparently had done a lot of steroids back in his bodybuilding days. But they weren't sure if he was still on steroids by the time he did Terminator. So Cliff, what do you think? Was Arnold on gear when he was doing the Terminator?
Oh yes, Arnold was definitely on gear when he was doing the Terminator and through his early movie roles.
So don't think that's Natty, his gigantic upside down pyramid shaped body?
Alas, no. A body like that can only be achieved with the miracles of modern medicine.
You cannot hold 240 extra pounds of muscle on your body just without... Mm-hmm. Anyway.
But an interesting story there is that, yeah, Arnold in his early movie career did retain much of the size of his bodybuilding career and was on heavy cycles of steroids. And I think he has been on steroids his whole life, because when you're on steroids for a little bit, shit doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But he made a conscious decision... Exactly. Conscious decision to downsize at one point that was... in the right before Total Recall, Paul Verhoeven needed him smaller in order to look like a dueling companion, plausible dueling companion with Michael Ironside. And there was a conscious decision on the part of Arnold and Michael and all that to decrease his size a good 20, 30 pounds. Mm-hmm. And that entered the 90s Arnold era, which was a slimmer, sleeker Arnold, still an action star, but not the kind of behemoth that he was through the 80s.
Yeah, no, he is still almost full bodybuilder big in that, which is what makes the idea of, again, even the character just arriving, which is part of the text of the movie, but arriving nude as they do, and which is another feature of the film, again, not having any money, not even being considered a science fiction film because they had no fancy time machines or spaceships like Star Wars or anything, is that Arnold arrives bare-ass naked. And again, it's one of those just perfect synchronicities of cast and a role that you get to see his butt, his dong, and his enormous fucking delts. And you know that the Terminator has arrived and all of that gay stuff.
Bring fit male butts back to media.
Yeah. No, this is what we're talking about. See, that's the point. We have, you know what, and I want to point this out, and I'm going to say this. I still have not seen the Twilight Batman, the Twee Batman. I have not seen the Robert, and I'm not going to. You know why? Because as we covered this, this is how long we have been doing this of our gap in the podcast, is that way back in the day, when we were first doing the podcast, we're near the end of the podcast, sorry, near the end of Scale is Needed, we covered the fact that Robert Pattinson said he would not be doing any kind of crazy physical exercise or routine to get in shape for Batman. He had the opportunity to get studio quality pharmaceuticals and studio and just fucking work out and get as jacked as he wants
just
all the fucking time.
Just as jacked as the three Chris's, man.
Exactly. And he pissed that away. He pissed that opportunity away, and that pissed me off. And so I will never see the Batman, because quite frankly, he is not the Batman. And I don't even like any of those fucking movies with Ben Affleck, but Ben Affleck looked jacked as fuck in those movies. So credit to the Batfleck on all of that.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. So there you go. But you know who didn't skip leg day? Arnold Schwarzenegger. And that's how we got that big old badonk that you see in the opening scene over Los Angeles.
And we thank him for that.
Yes. Indeed. Yeah, Arnold really is that scene, that moment, we really can say, therefore, is the beginning of the 80s action body. Because, you know, there was no stopping it after that. And Stallone got big after that. Stallone was probably on something before that, but then he got all juiced up on horse tea and whatever the hell else he is taking for Rambo 2, also written by James Cameron.
Oh, yeah, that's a little-known fact. James Cameron wrote Rambo 2.
Yes, there you go. In the same gap.
Actually, Rambo, First Blood, Part 2.
That's right.
To be fully correct.
Exactly. Then you got your Dolph Lundgrens getting in there, and you had a bunch of other jack bodies, and so Cliff and I arrived in this world full, and there really wouldn't be, this is an interesting full circle moment, because there really wouldn't be a podcast, including the original Scale is Needed podcast, if it weren't for specifically that scene in that movie. Think about it, Cliff. Think about it. Because you don't cast... This is a time travel issue here. You go back in time. You don't cast Lance Henriksen. It's not Arnold Schwarzenegger anymore. The era of the jacked bodybuilder, the jacked action star, doesn't happen. Therefore, you and I don't grow up seeing Arnold carrying that big fucking log on his shoulder in Commando and all of those kinds of movies. Therefore, we don't grow up buying muscle magazines, especially Cliff, and buying the Arnold workout books, especially Cliff, and buying other jacked-related stuff, especially Cliff. And then later on, eventually, after doing all of that, getting your younger brother involved in weightlifting, kind of post-college, you know, I had a few false starts. But then later on, getting into CrossFit, then later on, parallel-tracked, Armin Hammer is conceived by his parents. He's born. He lives an entire life. His life brings him to Austin. We start doing that podcast. Joined
by Daniel
and Chase.
Was there not a member named Chase? Was Chase involved?
There was. He's there eventually. Chase is in there. It's all happening. Chase, look forward to, by the way, Chase on us by that I mean look forward to surprise guests in upcoming episodes.
They don't know they're going to be surprise guests yet.
Yes.
But they're finding out now.
They would never listen to this. No, I'm kidding. Actually, but we have...
Their arms can be twisted. They owe us enough favors.
That's right. We know where the bodies are buried, if you will. So, but anyway, think about it, Cliff. The era of... If it's not for that casting, then we don't want to grow up watching the Barbarian Brothers movies and thinking that's just a normal way for two old people to live, to look. When it's like we assumed when you grew up, part of growing up was having gigantic square pectoral muscles, delts the size of basketballs, and being made out of bricks and mortar. And that was just what happened if you did calisthenics.
That was the birthright of every American citizen. That was certainly the premise. That's right. In which I went into the gym to start working out. I thought in about 2 or 3 years, I'll look just like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Got the Arnold Schwarzenegger book, eating the Arnold Schwarzenegger diet. Just ended up looking a lot more like I do now.
Mm-hmm.
So it does not work for everybody.
Yes, it doesn't work for everybody, but it did set us on a path. It went back in time and conceived, if you will, of this podcast. Didn't even know it in a roundabout way. But if it weren't for all of that, we wouldn't be sitting here. So this is why, to bring it back to Linda Hamilton, that very scene, including Arnold's butt and Jack's shoulders, is part of the way in which this podcast was brought into being, conceived, if you will.
Butt first.
You can't conceive anybody with butt stuff, Taylor. I read about it.
Butt first. You can't conceive anybody with butt stuff, Taylor. I read about it.
That's why it's both fun and difficult to talk about Terminator, because you can say a lot of the same shit other people said, but it's almost impossible to talk about it without speaking in hyperbolic terms, and yet the hyperbole is fully justified because it really was that influential. I mean, Arnold, James Cameron, the Scale is Needed podcast, cultural institutions that wouldn't have existed if it weren't for him being cast in that movie. So think about it.
And a really well thought out love story. Like, y'all can stay as masculine as you want, but there is a very quick, obviously, like within whatever she sends at the end, like 4 hours or 6 hours or however short time they had together. But a fully fulfilling, like fully, you know, believable series of events. Lots of Easter eggs for you to rewatch and kind of get the opinion spoiler that he may have already known that he was the John Connor's father and, you know, had kind of a secret mission to also make.
I think the idea is that John Connor knows, but Kyle Reese
maybe
doesn't
that's
know.
Where yeah. Because she's in her little tape recorder like I must let you know
he knows, and I think that's implied when he says that John Connor gave him the picture of
the mother,
but he doesn't know why.
That is one of the miracles of Terminator. It is often lumped in there with masculine action movies, but it's a movie that uniquely is appealing to all audiences, especially women. They love the movie. There was that, oddly enough, I saw like some single women in the theater Terminator just there to watch a movie, there to watch Terminator.
Yes, no,
on a weeknight.
No, it was a sold out screening, and in literally, this is something you don't get when you see the movie at home. Just sitting two seats down was a single woman all on her own, just there in the theater watching Terminator by herself, because it's just a good movie, which raises a lot of questions. Is she single? Would she date Cliff? Can we? Taylor,
can we
any
reach
thoughts?
It?
You weigh in on this.
No.
Where are you? Reach out. Just contact the Crowded Theater podcast if you're out there. No. No, but in, you know, truly, that my clumsy conception segue was just teeing up the fact that, yeah, the incredible story of the kind of waitress carrying the future and therefore mm-hmm. falls in love with the soldier who comes back to defend her, but who in a tremendous pretzel of time ends up conceiving the very savior that sent him back to protect him, and therefore it was his father and all of that, is just very, very beautiful and poetic all the way through until the end of the movie, where you see that the picture that was handed to him, the thing that he fell in love with, he fell in love not with her in the 5 days, but said he fell in love with the picture that was given to him by John Connor, is taken after she is already pregnant with Kyle Reese's child, and he wonders why she looks so sad in the picture, and the reason she looks so sad in the picture is because she is, of course, mourning him who is gone, and they are separated by an ocean of time.
Oh, so beautiful.
Yes, and
legitimately,
it's like, if you, I don't know if you ever saw, what was that, Somewhere in Time is like this, you know, with Christopher Reeve and Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman star in this movie that I can't believe I'm bringing up now because I haven't seen it in like 30 years. But like, it's a romantic time travel movie about star-crossed lovers across time. It's a romantic conceit that would work all on its own as a kind of story. And yet it is present in this otherwise completely masculine film, which mm-hmm. is a great segue into some of the deeper subtext of this movie. It was just hey, we're finally getting weird here, people. But it's a great subtext, or a great segue into the subtext of the movie, because this is a film that is overtly masculine in its form and overtly masculine in its subject, which is technology, artificial intelligence, robots, war. Guns, war, all of these things. And yet it is balanced by the fact that the light, the spirit, the soul at the center of all of these things is an every woman, a waitress, a mother who is carrying a child inside of her, something that is overtly feminine.
Mm-hmm.
And which is incidentally the same idea of, again, it's also, you know,
she was wearing a pink shirt the whole time. That's through right. all the oh, action funny. Sequences in the back half of the movie. She basically mm-hmm. never changed her wardrobe from the moment she left to go to the movies after talking to it. She even loses yep. the jacket, just pink shirt the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, and but seeing these things balanced the way they are, it is a idea that you will see echoed in many of his films, James Cameron's films moving forward. Obviously, you have Aliens, which is overtly, again, a film about technology, war, spaceships, guns, etc. And yet, the final conflict at the end of the movie is between a mother who has lost her original child, because she's been lost in space for 57 years in the form of Ripley, who has now found a surrogate child in Newt, who she is attempting to protect, and who is she trying to defend it from, this overt sort of evil demon mother figure, which is very get away from her, you bitch, the queen alien laying all of these eggs. And again, you see it in eventually in his superlatively successful, even by James Cameron's own standards, Titanic, where you again see this big budget action disaster movie, but that was driven to its enormous, enormous success, and I remember I lived through it at the time, was by the romance, by mm-hmm. Jack and whatever
Rose.
The fuck. Rose, Jack and Rose. There you go. Hey, Rose, another, there you go.
Just I have like, a friend named Rose.
There you go. But it's like another just overtly feminine name. But Jack and Rose, and they were, who were the people who saw Titanic 14 times in the theater? It was young women going out to see that movie over and over again. So you see the masculine and feminine aspects balanced within all of these movies dramatically and tonally, but it's perfectly integrated with and perfectly underscores all of the themes, both kind of explicit and implicit within the film. Because this is a movie that is about the merciless advance of technology, you know, which we see now in a much more real debate around, in and around artificial intelligence and AI and all this other kind of stuff. But at the time, in the 80s, this was Cold War times, and what is the Terminator born of? He is born of the fallout of the nuclear war between Russia and the United States, which is of course precipitated by Skynet, an AI who is given total control of all things, not unlike a god, a sort of robot god. And so what do we see
in the visual subtext of the movie very overtly throughout the entire thing. And I think this is really one of those things that plays much better in a movie theater when you're experiencing a film, the subtle energies of a film with a group of people. You open with the giant garbage trucks moving bins around, huge machines that sound not unlike the Hunter Killers. You then later on, obviously in the final sequence, see all of the different machines and robots. And in subtler ways throughout, you have all of these winking ideas about humanity giving itself over to machines. There is the answering machine, obviously, in the apartment. You know, hi, it's me. Just kidding. It's a machine. But hey, you know what? Machines need love too. Mm-hmm. You know, just the beautiful thing that ties in the subtext. And even Sarah Connor's roommate, what's her head?
Ginger.
Ginger. She has a Walkman that is constantly in her ears that you're seeing mechanically mm-hmm. play, to the extent that when it cuts to Ginger having sex with her boyfriend, not only is she still wearing the Walkman and still dancing to her Walkman music, but they're literally holding it with its turning gears up near their heads in the frame, so that even mm-hmm. sex is now being augmented by something mechanical, by some sort of machine. And obviously tech noir, the club, and all of these other technology things throughout. It is a film where you have all of these
aids in her death. She can't hear
exactly if she weren't wearing it absolutely
just throwing that
in.
Cherry on top of
no
the
if she her if she weren't wearing the headphones, she would be able to hear Arnold beating up her boyfriend and would have been able to get away, but she doesn't. All of that. So you have this film full of giant robots, but what does it mean in the 1980s versus what does it mean in 2024? And they are very related in a prescient way, but very interesting, because at the time, it's like the AI is in a sense metaphor. It's the idea of us giving ourselves over to technology in this unconscious way, developing bigger and bigger nuclear weapons, developing these missile systems that will automatically respond and destroy the world, the emergence of the military-industrial complex that is going to enslave and destroy the world, blah, 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 blah. And all of that is... what are the metaphors, and this is where we get directly to kind of what the Terminator is in a very clear way, what are the metaphors we use to underlie technology? That technology is a double-edged sword, you know, that that there is a some sort of there's sort of a trade-off that if you play with fire you get burned, all of these kinds of ideas that are sort of innate to the idea that if we develop technologies there will be potential blowback, potential unforeseen consequences and paranoia about that. The biggest one looming large in the 80s was, of course, the threat of nuclear annihilation. Something that's making a fun comeback, you guys. It's making a fun comeback these days. But what is the defining characteristic of the Terminator in all of his scenes, and then in all of even the idea that he gets his burned and then gets his legs blown off, but he just keeps coming. He just keeps coming after fucking Linda Hamilton. He keeps coming after Sarah Connor. It's the idea that he cannot be stopped. He doesn't stop. He's just moving forward, which is a very unique idea. We take it for granted because it's part of the Terminator. It just keeps moving forward. There is no... it doesn't have any mercy, which is what Kyle says. It doesn't have any pity.
You can't reason with it.
You can't reason with it. It just keeps marching forward. And that is both... what the crazy scary robot skeleton in the movie is, but it's also how we certainly viewed military technology, how we view technology mm-hmm. in general, and how we view technology today. There was this idea, and then we kind of, and that is an idea that in the interim kind of chilled the fuck out in the 90s a little bit, in the sense that in the 80s there was this fatalistic idea that if we develop all of these systems of destruction and all of these weapons and all of this nuclear technology, that eventually we will destroy ourselves. Then the Soviet Union falls, then everything chills out, we get the internet, turns out computers are fucking cool and awesome and they say hi to you and stuff, and everything's easy and convenient because it's on a screen, and suddenly we, not unlike the Eloys and the Morlocks, find ourselves sort of lulled into a kind of complacency where by 2024 we now weirdly find ourselves watching Terminator re-afraid of the threat of nuclear war, and also imminently dealing with the consequences of AI. But how are people talking about AI now? They're talking about it in the same fatalistic ways that we talk about the Terminator. Well, you know, well, there's ChatGPT and other AI programs are just going to take all the jobs from all the writers or take jobs from artists, or they're going to have various negative consequences. But there's nothing you can do about it because technology can't be stopped. If we don't do it, someone else will. And also this desire to eventually give birth to some sort of supermind, Skynet, and the idea that eventually we'll hand over full control of our world to this godlike supercomputer, Skynet. And so the what was metaphor is now reality, and unfortunately what was reality, the nuclear weapons, is also now double reality. So in a weird way, I feel like, you know, I don't know, the film portraying technology as this ravenous, maniacal, unstopping death knight emerging from a hellish fire with red glowing eyes, coming for us and coming for us and coming for us, and it will not stop and it cannot be reasoned with, is honestly feels like it reflects the same anxieties we're dealing with right now about AI and right now about nuclear weapons. Well, big things are moving forward like a train, and there's no stopping the train. And I think that is the deeper metaphor that is really genuinely frightening about the Terminator. I remember even as a kid talking to my mom about when she first saw the Terminator and what she thought was so, why it was so scary. And the first thing out of her mouth was, it just kept coming. You know, that was what was so scary about it. It just kept coming. You know, so it kept coming after it was shot. You kept coming after it got blown up. It kept coming, blah, blah, blah. It just kept coming after you because it can't be mercy. There is no there. There's nothing behind the eyes of it. There is no mustache twisting villain with it. There isn't even animal instincts for self-preservation or to reproduce itself. There's just the mechanistic extension of an idea. Maximize paperclips. Create the most number of paperclips, and if that means turning you and all of us here into paperclips, that's just what it will do, because it's just one rule. Kill Sarah Connor. And again, How long has it been? 40 years on now? We are zeroing in on 2029, and this is another thing that you don't get unless you're seeing a movie in a movie theater, which is just the fact that when 2029 first pops up on the screen and you see this desolate nuclear wasteland, there was a kind of nervous chuckle through the audience. Just in the sense, I think that we all felt in our bones that reality and that version of 2029 felt like they were converging fatalistically in exactly the way that was predicted in the film Terminator. As we escalate towards nuclear war, as we escalate towards AI seemingly being incredibly disruptive and potentially destructive, and yet what are you going to do about it? You can't stop it. And that is why films like this just continue to live on and stuff. Cliff, your thoughts?
Oh, about the longevity of the Terminator?
No, not the longevity of the Terminator, but anything. I've just been talking for too long. But just, yes. Well, how is it different seeing the film in 2024, I guess, than 1984?
Well, it would have been a dream to see it in 1984. Unfortunately, I would have been a one-year-old babe. Unlikely
exactly
I was in
one
the theater. I probably would have cried. So I think there was a slight percentage less crying in this movie than there in 2024 than there would be in 84.
That is a good point.
But no, the amazing thing is that it's played very much like a modern movie that everyone was out at the theater to have a good time seeing. It wasn't one of those repertory screenings of an older movie that everyone is there to applaud politely at and pat themselves on the back for going to. No, it's a movie that everyone is there to be entertained by, and everyone in the theater was thoroughly entertained. They laughed, they cried, presumably. We couldn't really get any close-ups, but there was probably some tears.
As mentioned at the beginning of this, it was literally a Tuesday night that we saw this on, and it was a full theater on a Tuesday night. And so not a Friday or Saturday, like people after
work
came out and saw
Can still pack a weeknight theater to the brim.
Sure.
That is a hell of a movie.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, but to get back to some of the other stuff, I was trying to think about the themes of the Terminator. Why do they continue to resonate to this day? And I think it has to do with the fact that I think many of, and this is not necessarily a controversial statement unto itself, but I think that the the lessons that we were hoping to learn as a society around that time, we did the opposite of learning. Instead, the fall of the Soviet Union, while definitely probably a good thing overall, created a kind of complacency where by the time we were young kids, we thought we were at the end of history and technology was only going to bring us cool and awesome stuff in the future. And yet, and that's the thing, is that this film, and I when I saw it back then, probably would have viewed it as an overly cynical take on advancing technology and on AI. You would look at the Terminator as a worst-case scenario of the most malevolent version. I mean, truly, this and then The Matrix, which followed it, the most malevolent version of how technology runs.
At least the Matrix dudes wanted to keep humans alive for some reason.
Exactly.
The HKs just wanted to exterminate us all.
Yes. No, the idea that nowadays, I don't know, it seems almost more like when I watch it, I feel as if I ask the question, is the Terminator future an inevitability philosophically from the principle of that defined the, let's say, the 80s and 90s, the kind of technologist perspective, the secular materialist perspective, is the Terminator future inevitable? Because you can view it as maybe, and just to tee this up slightly more, this idea that it's a film fundamentally about a kind of Promethean act, the idea of stealing fire from the gods as technology, stealing steel from the rocks to kill gods, the idea that instead of having any spiritual intuition or idea that men have souls, you know, or something that is non-material, that they have some, that there is some spiritual component, we instead in the 20th century adopted this idea of a wholly material world, that if, unless you can see it, smell it, measure it, touch it, it does not exist. And therefore, there, in some ways, the quest to create human-like machines and all of our art about machines that would eventually wake up and have emotions and stuff. And this is the interesting thing, is that Skynet is self-aware and yet clearly has no mercy and no empathy and no humanity to it, despite its awareness, is that it's precisely the same dilemma that we are dealing with these days, which is this idea that if AI is capable of generating great works of art or great pieces of music or poetry or jokes, then we get to go on down the merry. And most people, by the way, many, many, many smart and influential people believe that that is where we're headed. I actually do not. I do not think that is ever going to happen. But think about it. If that happens, it certainly would speak towards the idea that maybe we are what science has told us we are for the last 70 years. That is to say, we are essentially a very advanced machine with a very advanced computer, and one day when our computers and our technologies get advanced enough, we'll have something that looks and acts just like us, and it'll have a soul that's looking out in precisely the same way that we do. And yet, what if that's not true? What if it's just metaphysically not true? What if what we're discovering as we realize that passing the Turing test was actually a lot easier than we thought, and I know some people will think that that's kind of dumb, but people thought if you were talking to a machine and it sounded like a person and blah, 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 if you're talking to a machine, then there's a there. There would be some sort of robot intelligence, or at least the elemental or nascent form of a robot intelligence there talking to you. But what we realize now, and I think now that many of these things are aggregated from huge data sets on the internet and whatever, is that you can affect conversation and still be a toaster. You can, and as we've learned, could AI generate art? A lot of people say yes. In fact, a lot of people say it's proven that AI can generate art, except it can't really generate art. It can just recombine art and images that were created by other people, that is to say forms, images, symbols that were and styles that were created by other people, remix them, recombine them, and then generate an image that is some combination thereof. But as we've learned, it can do that, in fact, really make it look cool, and still be a toaster, and still not have a there. Now your phone, which is definitely doesn't have a soul, can do that thing that we thought would have been impossible without a soul to render something, blah, blah, blah.
Go Scarlett ahead. Johansson isn't really falling in love with you.
Exactly. Scarlett Johansson really is not falling in love with you in Her. This is a reference to the movie Her. There you go.
I don't know if I've ever actually seen that.
Yeah, well, it's a good example.
It's just a sexy phone falls in love with a guy movie.
By the way,
the phone is played by Scarlett Johansson, and the guy is played by what's his face, Joaquin Phoenix, in Nerd Mode.
Yes, very much.
But the illusion, very much present in people's minds at the time that movie came out, was the idea that intelligence would emerge from computers and start talking out of our phones like real people. And the premise of Her, and it was very much a widespread premise, is that you could continue to that the intelligence in the phones would continue to develop to where it would have a real soul and would be able to fall in love and have friends and personal desires and all that stuff.
The Kurzweilian hypothesis.
Indeed. And we see in Her that the phone gets more and more intelligent to the point where it has relationships of its own that it wants. It wants to grow past him, yada yada. It has a life of its, an inner life of its own. And what ChatGPT is finally convincing us of is that the phone can talk at you and convince you that it is a person, but most likely it's just trying to get your credit card number for some sort of Russian scam or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's more likely how AI is going to be in the future, and I don't think anyone's under the illusion that ChatGPT is an intelligent thing with a real inner life going on.
Yes.
Thinking its soullessness is being revealed in creepy ways to everybody all the time.
It's the kind of thing where it's just like AI art or ChatGPT or anything where you go along and it's like a glitch in the Matrix where it seems on the surface to affect the appearance of something created by a human, and then you'll suddenly see a hand with six fingers, or the fact that it can't really generate jokes, or any of the things that let you know that
they all have watercolor labels or signatures in their art, where it literally is.
Yes. Yeah, the little the evidence of where it actually pulled stuff from, but just the fact that it reveals that there's nothing behind the art or even behind the sentences that ChatGPT are saying that even knows what a human being is, that even has a concept of what three-dimensional space is. It can repeat words that were once processed by a human being back to you in a way that more often than not can deliver a very satisfying response, and yet there is no there. Suddenly it will say something or generate people getting into trouble. I mean, Francis Ford Coppola got into trouble this last week because Megalopolis released a trailer that featured a bunch of weird quotes about The Godfather attributed to critics that didn't exist, and quite literally the explanation given was whoever was putting together the trailer used ChatGPT that just made up critic quotes that didn't exist. So you imagine this person who had reliably used ChatGPT as a research tool, thinking that it was researching the information and giving it to them, and then realized that that ChatGPT was like a game of Pong. It was just batting words back at that person and Googling the validity of the arrangement of words such that it could get a positive response back from the human. But it doesn't know what a film is. It doesn't know what research is. There is no there. And so the exact same dilemma that we're learning about AI now is precisely the same thing that is at the core of the Terminator. There is no mercy. There is no pity. There is no there. Now,
it's the opposite message of Blade Runner. The thing we take away from the robots in the Terminator is not that there is some bit of humanity hidden deep in there, but that there is nothing to be found.
Yes.
And that is the dark version of AI found in the Terminator. Mm-hmm. That AI never will really wake up. It'll maybe start acting towards some goal or some end, but it won't really wake up.
Yeah.
Underneath that nice, warm, firm butt is just the cold shell of a monster.
That's right. It's warm and as firm as all of the butts are going to be in the future, and they're going to be firm.
They're
going to
be firm.
Trust me, you guys, it's a real problem for the future of humanity. But But no pun intended. No, the what was it? The shit. I just lost my train of thought. The butts just they distracted
me. Mind wipes. Yeah.
Yeah. No, but this idea that they're not being a there. Is both a terrifying, it's a terrifying idea in Terminator, and yet it is what we are discovering right now. So what has been the response of the world, the Elon Musks and the Bill Gateses of the world, as we slowly realize that maybe there is in fact something mystical behind humans, that you can pass the Turing test, but it can't write a joke, that it can create a beautiful oil painting in any style, but it can't really create something new. Mm-hmm. What happens when you realize that maybe there's one extra part, as all religious traditions have told us since time immemorial, that the soul has a non-corporeal element, a division of God or of some collective unconscious or something that is peering through, the mechanism that is the brain, that is peering through the mechanism that is the body and looking out to experience the world. Now, of course, that's all silly talk. We got past that shit in the 90s. We don't need to worry about that anymore. God is stupid and old and from the past. And yet, those same people who believed that and believe that to still be part of the reality that we live in, how far will they go to prove that the soul doesn't exist? And what are they doing? What are the Bill Gateses and Elon Musks of the world doing? They are now dumping hundreds of billions of dollars into just building bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger data processing centers to create a more powerful and more powerful and more powerful computer that can give us more and more and more back what we want when and look at even bigger and bigger data sets in the hope that one day, now that unfortunately we've passed the threshold of the Turing test and it didn't happen, that one day the computer will wake up and it will actually have a there that's looking back out. So the question becomes, what happens if that doesn't happen? And Terminator, especially the first film by contrast to the second film, which opens the possibility of a robot having a soul in the second film, but I can actually get into that because I think there's an interesting esoteric reading on that as well. But this film points out the fact that if we were to give all of the capabilities of decision-making and thought and rationality over to something that was better at rationality and thinking and technology than us, that thing would not be a human being. That thing would not be a being. That thing would not have a soul or would not have mercy or pity or even be able to create anything at all. It would be a terrible monster, almost inevitably. There's the example I've referenced earlier of the malevolent paperclip maximizer, the idea of evil AI. If you turn things, you know, turning it has one just it has one rule: maximize paperclips, and therefore it turns all things, including all humans, into paperclips.
It's a thought experiment that I think came from Sam Harris at some point.
There you go.
About if you're going to create a super powerful AI, you have to program it with the correct goals. Mm-hmm. So if you gave, say, a super powerful, omnipotent AI the singular goal of, he picked something very deliberately silly and mundane, of making paperclips, of maximizing the number of paperclips mm-hmm. in the world. And then if you gave it that sole goal without giving it, without programming in the full context of human values, human morality, you know, all that kind of stuff, that it would eventually just decide to turn the whole world into paperclips, kill all humans, destroy all life, turn everything into paperclips, that in order to make the AI, and that's not with putting a malevolent intention in the AI, just maximizing paperclips is not on its surface a malevolent intention. But just giving even a mundane intention without the full context of humanity, if it's of a real human soul programmed in there, for lack of a better word, that it would do malevolent things by default. And so that is what we can kind of see in the Terminator, where, say, defense network computers, new, powerful, hooked into everything, trusted to run it all. No doubt they were given the defense network computers, the unnamed in Terminator 1, Skynet, was given the simple mission of, you know, protecting the home front and looking out for itself probably as a secondary motive, that then, in its simple paperclip maximizer brain, it somehow concluded that wiping all humanity out mm-hmm. would serve its very simple goal. Mm-hmm.
And that's,
Skynet didn't have a soul.
Yes, but when we take that as just this idea of a malevolent robot taking over in the first film, but look at how many people now, with an almost religious zeal, I think there are people now who would welcome that annihilation, would welcome the annihilation of nuclear war, would welcome the annihilation of humanity itself. And the reason they would welcome that annihilation is because you can only move in the direction of continuing to build and turn over more control and make it more powerful. This the building of all of these data centers is the Terminator. It is the thing that cannot be stopped. You know, it will not be stopped. It has to move forward. The idea that the only way to stop is to recognize that a human being has something more within him or her or in her belly, which is what John Connor represents, JC, Jesus Christ. The idea that there is, we are impregnated with some humanity that is, in fact, and this is something that I don't think James Cameron would even agree with, but yet it is part of his story, which was delivered to him in a fever dream, is that counter-rational as well. That is to say, Kyle Reese goes back in time, gives birth to John Connor, who then rises, stops the machine, sends back Kyle Reese, etc. It's a weird time pretzel that both works and also utterly doesn't make sense, because it doesn't really account for where the idea of stopping the machines ever began with in the first place. Therefore, it speaks to a non-corporeal soul outside of reality. It's like the Back to the Future problem of, well, who really wrote the riff for Johnny B. Goode? It speaks to the fact that rock and roll, and I do believe this because this is literally, I did an entire podcast about Bob Zemeckis, by the way, for those who don't know, so you should go listen to many episodes of that.
Bob Zemeckis is not a butthead.
Exactly. But the idea that God created rock and roll, it comes from something, it does not come from human genius, it comes from non-corporeal genius or some spirit. Literally, as Kiss would tell us in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, God gave rock and roll to you. And this is what is implied here, the uncanniness of the time loop, the idea of the revolutionary spirit of Reese, and then ultimately Sarah Connor when she gets to the second film, which she imparts to her son, and then it comes back and gives it to Kyle Reese, who then goes back and gives it to Sarah Connor, is something that exists outside of the materialist mechanistic world of lists and data and things that can be set up and paid off. It is something that transcends the rational. So to take it back to our world for a second, as we escalate towards nuclear war, as we are building rapid-fire trillion-dollar data centers covering up all of our farmland in the desperate hope that someday something finally, for all of our effort, wakes up and actually talks back to us and isn't just a very, very, very clever jack-in-the-box or a toaster that knows how to talk. As we do all of these things, we have now invested ourselves metaphysically, because I think for a large part of the world would rather see the world annihilated than sort of admit that maybe we got the whole, you know, throwing everything, all of spirituality out with the bathwater is somehow wrong, or there is a there. Imagine any technologist actually copping to that at any point. It's more, we can imagine it more these days, maybe, but hard to picture. Who would rather eventually build all of the data centers and finally, as it is described in 1984, not the book, but the movie, Terminator, the 1984 movie, they had no choice but to eventually give over all control to Skynet. So they voluntarily, not no choice, they voluntarily give over all control to Skynet. We already know now that AI fucks things up and doesn't know what's going on. And yet we are in this hurry to turn everything over to AI as quickly as possible because essentially of the promise that all things that are corporeal work, having to, you know, do thankless tasks will all be taken care of by robot slaves who we can, and finally, utterly, and that's what that's what the film represents. Utterly enshrine our own works, our own steel, our own iron, our own reason, our own math as God, to replace God, to create all the loaves and fishes, and to use computers to replace the soul, and all of these out of all of these old ideas. That if we've made that Faustian bargain, if we've done that thing, then the Terminator future is an inevitability. That is to say, we would rather be there's much of the world, and this is where we're kind of getting into more of a, hopefully there will be a spiritual awakening that frees us from nuclear war and other sorts of things, but that spiritual awakening might have its source, not unlike John Connor and Kyle Reese and Sarah Connor's revolutionary nature, in something that exists outside of reality. That is to say, if there is in fact, and it's a metaphysical issue, it's an epistemological issue, but it's a metaphysical issue, that if the machines never wake up, if they just keep building data centers and it's just a really sophisticated toaster at the end of the day, then it's not only about the loss on the material level of the trillions of dollars of investment in computers and all of that over the course of the past 10 years, multiple decades. It's about the total philosophical collapse of the secular materialist worldview, that man is merely a computer, a mechanism, if you will, that that one day when we build a sophisticated enough mechanism, we will have built man. And therefore, it requires not only rewriting the whole 20th century, but rewriting many of the underlying metaphysical and epistemological assumptions of and in the entire generation we grew up in. And most people don't want to do that. So they'd rather just roll the dice and give the controls, just like it says in Terminator, over to Skynet. Let it take the reins on the hope, the faith, that maybe this time the thing that's answering all your questions but occasionally getting something wildly factually wrong or creating people with six fingers, maybe there is something there on the other side of it. But what if it doesn't happen? Then Skynet, then Rise of Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines. Cliff.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's scary. Cool. Sorry, we won't mess with the computer. There we go. So everybody, what have we not said about the Terminator? Is there anything left? What is left on this thing? I think we've talked for a good long while about it. No, we basically covered everything. Oh, there's one more thing to do, everybody, on this podcast, and this will be something, two fun things to do at the very end. Cliff, this should be very obvious, we will do, in honor of Scale as Needed, Cliff will award one person in each movie with the Full Metal Jacked Award for the most jacked. So question,
that,
let me ask
that
you,
is
Cliff.
Right, yes. The origins of the Full Metal Jacked Award go back to the original Scale as Needed podcast, where there was a, I don't know, for anyone who's not into fitness, I don't know if you'll be aware of what a pre-workout is, but it's a little powder you put in your drink before a workout to get you super jazzed up to work out. And there was a really, really bad pre-workout called Full Metal Jacked.
Indeed,
but Full Metal Jacket is a movie, and so it's a cool name.
Yes, and so the award will be going to whoever is the most jacked in any movie that we watch. And Cliff, I don't feel like I really have to ask you this question because we know the answer already.
Well,
who is the most jacked person in Terminator?
Yes, obviously Terminator's kind of a shoe-in. Arnold Schwarzenegger defined what jacked was for a generation of movies, as has been already discussed. Mm-hmm. Other movies, it'll be a little more difficult. There'll be some room for debate on A Fish Called Wanda or something like that. But clearly that Arnold Schwarzenegger, the only other competition within the film, obviously, is Michael Biehn, who, shredded and fit though he was, did not have that unique superhuman steroid bodybuilder look that only the Austrian Oak could bring. So the first Full Metal Jacked Award of the restarting of the Scaleless Nation podcast, of course, goes to Arnold Schwarzenegger in The Terminator.
Ding, ding, ding. Arnold, the only first recipient of the Scale is Needed Award, or sorry, the Full Metal Jacked Award. Cool, awesome. And now, like we said, there is, not unlike, who wrote Johnny B. Goode? Was it Marty McFly or was it Chuck Berry? We don't know, quite frankly. Where did the revolutionary spirit to smash the machines come from? Where did it come from? It came from outside of reality. It came from the spirits. So now we will end this podcast, like all good seances should end, by consulting with the spirits. We have here a tarot deck that I have previously shuffled and drawn. And we will draw. We can only speculate as to the meanings of the film. What will actually determine the hidden meanings of Terminator will be the drawing of this tarot card. So it's the one right on top, babe. So Cliff coincidentally brought up the Death card, which is actually a really good card for representing. It is both the Scorpio card, and this was a Scorpio movie, as well as it literally has a skull-faced knight on it who represents death. And as we talked about, if we make machines, if we fully invest in enshrining with divinity, non-corporeal reality, what happens? We inevitably, it becomes an avatar of death. So I guess the question is, what card did we draw? Taylor, would you like to draw it for us?
It was
the chariot card. Fantastic.
I thought it was going to be the death card. I'm so convinced.
Oh, no. Really. All right, it's the chariot card. All right, Cliff, hold that up in front of that camera over there.
There we go.
Well, the chariot card is good because that means great success in all endeavors, but it also has many deeper meanings that speak directly to the core of Terminator. Now, if you look here on the chariot card, you see that the chariot is leaving the city guided by two, what was originally horses on older versions of the tarot, but is now two, basically looks like sphinxes. They have lion bodies and sphinx heads, so you can hold that up there. And those represent exactly the masculine and feminine aspects that we were talking about being so well balanced in this film. What makes the chariot successful? The chariot is a balance of those rational and intuitive energies, those solar and lunar energies, those masculine and feminine energies. The Terminator has both within it this brilliant contemplation of the most purely masculine idea, machines and technologies of war and their inevitable fatalistic natures, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time has an immaculate conception of a sort and has all of these different feminine energies in it, the pregnancy, the John Connor, all of that. And it was a tremendously successful film because it was able to harness and balance those two energies, just as, and I remember when I consulted with the deck, I asked it for a card that would speak both to the hidden things about the Terminator and the future of this podcast. And as you can see, why will this podcast be 10 times more successful than Scale is Needed ever was? Because it has a balance of masculine and feminine energies. Taylor is here to balance those feminine energies. Isn't that right, Taylor? So which one are you? Are you the black sphinx with the big boobs, or are you the white sphinx with the big boobs?
Oh, they both have boobs?
They both
I
have
think,
boobs.
I think the black sphinx has no boobs. I think the You're black true. Sphinx is the male, and the white sphinx is the boobs.
Perhaps. But either way, they both have boobs. Cliff, hold it up there
they
just so the people
nipples,
at home can see
maybe,
the boobs.
Not boobs. Do you see boobs on the black sphinx?
So if you're watching on the video component of the podcast, you can see the big boobs.
You can help
I know,
debate
we might
the boobs.
We might be right. You can decide for yourselves here, but is the do we have two a female sphinx and a male sphinx, or just one female sphinx? You can only really make out the boobs on the white one, so we might I'll leave it up to the comments to decide.
Yes, but there you go. So there you go. A lot of esoteric wisdom, a lot of fantastic. This is the kind of high-quality, all-encompassing podcasting that you are going to on the Crowded Theater every week, probably. So
find out.
And I would like to say thank you guys for joining us. I guess we can wrap it up. I will say we're going to post this to all the things we can, but we will say that if you put on iTunes, give us a 5-star review, we will read whatever the hell you write in that review on this podcast. It's something we did in the early days of Scale is Needed. 5-star reviews and shares and likes and subscribes matter. So if you give us a 4-star review, that's fine, but we're not reading shit. If you give us a 5-star review, however, you could just put a fucking cookie recipe in there. I'll read the whole thing.
You can make an emojicon of a penis. I'll say hashtag #?D.
Yes, exactly. So you could write dialogue for the three of us in there and we'll try and act it out. Mm-hmm. But either way, put a 5-star review on the iTunes or on all of those things. Like and share, and especially share the stuff. I hope you guys enjoy this. I hope we do more of these. And so for the Crowded Theater, I'm Kyle.
I'm Taylor.
And I'm Cliff.
Signing off, and get your ass to the movies.
once.